The year 2013 saw the passing of many Iowans who made a real difference in their lifetimes. This hour, we remember a number of them. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we talk with people who can tell us a little about some of the Iowans from the news who died in 2013, including civil rights leader Ruth Anderson, author Curtis Harnack, pioneering blind athlete Sheila Holsworth, Colonel Bud Day, Richard Tapscott of the Des Moines Register, RAGBRAI co-founder Carter LeBeau, Come and Go entrepreneur William Krause, and Pauline Phillips, better known as Dear Abby. Remembering these Iowans and others in the news. After this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we're remembering some of the Iowans who passed away in 2013. And certainly one thing that instantly springs to mind when you mention Iowa, RAGBRAI. And this summer, we Iowans and RAGBRAI lost Carter LeBeau of Davenport, who passed away at the age of 87. Carter was one of the original RAGBRAIers. He was part of RAGBRAI for some four decades. Joining us now, Carter LeBeau's widow, Kay LeBeau. Mrs. LeBeau, welcome to our program and our condolences for your loss.
Thank you very much.
He was recognized by RAGBRAI writers for his socks. Carter was. Tell us about those socks.
Well, this all started with the original ride across Iowa when he saw in the newspaper that they were going to do this. So he got four of his friends, and they drove out from Davenport, and he wanted to have something kind of special for it, so he purchased all these colorful socks so that they each wore them every day and with a different color on each foot. So, and this just continued all through the years.
Never matching, in fact.
That's right. Yes.
So when he talked about the early days of RAGBRAI, what did he seem to love most about it?
Oh, the people and how welcoming they were. And
did he have a favorite story that he liked to share about RAGBRAI? I imagine if you do RAGBRAI for 40 years, you have quite a collection of stories.
I guess one was when he started doing homestays. He did that not too long after he started, and this couple in Marshalltown was going to provide a home for Carter and his friend. And when they arrived at the house, there was a note on the door saying they'd been called out of town, but they indicated where the key was for the house, which bedroom they were each to sleep in. The keys to the car were in such and such a place. And there was beer in the refrigerator.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was just, they were so trusting.
Honest to goodness truth. That's amazing. How do you think Carter would like to be remembered by bike enthusiasts, by the RAGBRAI Nation?
Just the fact that he enjoyed doing what RAGBRAI was meant to be, a ride across Iowa, experiencing the Iowa culture and the towns and the scenery. And I think he just would like to be remembered as enjoying all that they had to offer.
Kay LeBeau, thank you very much for sharing a little bit about your husband, who died in August, Carter LeBeau, one of the original RAGBRAIers. Kay LeBeau, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Also this year, we lost Dick Thompson, who died in August at the age of 81. In the mid-1980s, Thompson co-founded the Practical Farmers of Iowa. Joining us now to remember his life and work, another co-founder of the Practical Farmers of Iowa, Larry Callum. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Perhaps begin by telling us how Dick started his farming career.
Well, Dick started his farming career after having gained his master's degree in animal science from Iowa State, and began as a typical conventional farmer. And it was that early experience with conventional farming that caused him to rethink how he did things.
What practices did he challenge, for instance, that were reigning wisdom of the time?
Well, he did go back to crop rotations, they say, and put livestock back in the farming operation. For many years, the numbers of livestock in farms, particularly those farms in what you'd call cash grain areas, where the land is level and the soil is deep and black, that land had been going entirely into crops. In the 1950s and before, the manure from the animals, dairy cattle, beef cattle, hogs, going back onto the land. As you went toward cropping-only systems, there was no longer that organic matter to put back on the land, but rather chemical fertilizers were put on instead to keep the fertility levels and the yields up. It tended to hurt the soil structure as time went by. It also resulted in loss of bacterial action in the soil, the loss of earthworms and things that nature had been using for years to keep things healthy. Those things were being substantially hurt. He saw that and tried to take steps to regain it, to mm-hmm. get back to a balance.
What are the kinds of discoveries did he make?
Well, Dick was a researcher. He would test things side by side in his fields. He'd have a strip doing things one way and right next to it a strip doing it another way, and he'd compare and see how it turned out. He would not just evaluate whether the crop looked good, but how the economics of it worked out. He checked his bottom line year after year and compared those different trials to see which made him the most money. He found, just to simplify it a great deal, that if you could keep your inputs down and your technology more simple, manage your machinery costs, you could make more money per acre and have healthier land. And he proved that many times over for years and years, to the point where conventional farmers decided maybe there was something to that and started looking at what he had to say. And it came to be that people all over the world took an interest and flocked to his farm for the field days he held to find out what it was he was doing and why.
Mm-hmm. He helped found the Practical Farmers of Iowa. How and why did that get founded?
This was founded in 1985, which was called the Farm Crisis. So this was a time when you wanted to cut back on costs, cut back on inputs. So lowering inputs while still maintaining your yield was the key to survival.
Mm-hmm. And what difference has the Practical Farmers of Iowa organization made in the meantime?
Well, Practical Farmers of Iowa is and has been an on-farm research organization that allows a forum for exchange of information, ideas, and research from farms all over the state and beyond the state. Other farmers around the state have taken up his field day pattern, and farmers from their area, from the area around each of those farms, would come and see what that member of Practical Farmers is doing.
How would you sum up Dick Thompson's legacy as a farmer?
He was a mentor to thousands of people, many of whom, of course, had never actually seen him, but they read what he did, they heard him speak, and he caused people's lives to change. That's about how you would define, I guess, many people's, including my own, and perhaps your goal in life is to look back on it at some point and say, you know what, I think maybe I made a difference. Well, here was a man who made a huge difference.
Larry Callum, thank you very much for helping us remember Dick Thompson, who passed away 2013. Thank you, Larry.
You're welcome, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we're remembering Iowans we lost. In 2013, we said goodbye to Curtis Harnack, a writer whose novels, nonfiction works, and an acclaimed memoir were inspired by his experience growing up on an Iowa farm. He died in July at his home in Manhattan at the age of 86. Writer Alan Gerganis delivered the eulogy at Harnack's service, and he joins us now. Alan Gerganis, welcome.
Thank you, Ben. It's good to be here.
How would you describe Curtis Harnack as a writer?
I think he was a beautiful embodiment of German-American farming stock in the sense that he got things done in prose, that windowpane kind of prose that's perfectly clear.
For someone who hasn't read Harnack's masterpiece, the memoir We Have All Gone Away, how would you describe how he portrays his early life in Iowa in that book?
It sounds like a kind of paradise in a way. to grow up on a farm with 1,000 acres that all belongs to you and your tribe. He is writing not only about his childhood farm, but about farms in general and Midwestern farms. And he talks about the iconography of the barn, for example, as a place where animal husbandry happens and where farm boys wrestle farm girls into hay bales if they possibly can. it's a wonderful, wonderful book, and it's become an important book in American studies programs all over the world. It's a kind of codification of the meaning of the farm apart from just the utility of the farm.
You were a young writer visiting the revered arts colony Yaddo in New York while Curtis Harnack was its head. Tell us what that experience means to a young artist.
Yeah, he actually was the perfect person to run the place, both because he worked every day himself as a writer and was extremely productive in fiction and nonfiction, and because of his experience in Iowa growing up on a farm, he knew how to fix things. He knew how to keep the roads cleared in the winters that were almost as bad in Saratoga, New York, as they were in Iowa City. He understood how things worked, and he treated the people who worked on the grounds with the same dignity that he brought to bear on the artist that he had dinner with every night.
And very gentle in any criticism. You have a very humorous story you told in his eulogy about chicken being on the menu.
That's right. Yes, I mean, you'd think people would be grateful when they get free meals for 2 months and a beautiful place to stay. But, you know, I think even in paradise, there are going to be people complaining that they didn't get a corner room. And we had a lady there who, having sort of flirted with Kurt, decided that she would take a reverse course and start complaining about the food. She complained that chicken, 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 all they ever feed us here is chicken. And Kurt, in one of his rare moments of standing up for himself, said, sometimes we find it easier to change the guests than the menu. And even she got the hint that she should probably pipe down and enjoy what was given. But he was very slow to anger, and he had a lot of crazy temperamental artists coming and going. I was, as a young person, I was always more impatient with the artists than he was. But he had a way of relaxing people. Sometimes people would arrive and feel unnoticed, and he could talk to them and calm them down and settle them in. He seemed always to remember the work of each of the artists who was there and to be able to refer to it. And, of course, there's nothing that calms a horse down faster than being given an apple in that way.
And finally, Alan Gurganus, how will you remember Curtis Harnack, the man?
I remember his integrity, his quietness, his confidence. I think growing up on a farm in Iowa was extraordinarily important to him. It brought with it a respect for work of all kinds, manual labor included. But I think he was a true Democrat, and he respected young people and old people equally, and left a tremendous legacy. He's not one of those people that you think about first, but he's one of those people who made other people's work the real center of his life. And I think his best work will be remembered forever.
Alan Gurganus, thank you for helping us remember Curtis Harnack. We lost in 2013. He died in July at his home in Manhattan. Alan, thanks for these remembrances.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Next, a man who was a big part of bringing news to many Iowans. Former Des Moines Register managing editor Richard Tapscott died after being diagnosed with an aggressive form of cancer in October. Coworkers described Tapscott as an exceptional boss and an exceptional human. Joining us to talk a little bit about Richard Tapscott, his life and his work, Clark Kaufman, investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register. Hi, Clark.
Hi, nice to be here.
How long did you were you able to work with Richard?
About 4 years, not nearly long enough. I would have liked to have spent a lot more time with him than I had the chance to.
What made Richard Tapscott such an effective and well-liked managing editor?
Well, you know, that's one of those questions. If if somebody could really definitively answer that, they'd probably be a millionaire. But I grew up reading the Register, and so when I started working there in 2001, when I first met Rick, he just struck me as the sort of the physical embodiment of everything that was good about the Register. And it was really hard to pin down what exactly those qualities were, but the most immediate and obvious thing was that he just carried himself with an air of professionalism. He was very open and very engaging with people, and that immediately came across. But it also was this level of professionalism that you could feel just by being in the same room with him.
For those who are not terribly acquainted with the newspaper business, tell us, what does a managing editor do on a day-to-day basis?
He's the guy who basically makes the trains run on time. The editor, the executive editor of the paper, is usually doing the big picture stuff. But it's the managing editor who really drives the stories, makes sure that the assignments are going to the right people, that they're getting done on time, that they're given the proper play. They very often play a critical role in deciding what goes on page one. So they're sort of the day-to-day person in charge of getting the paper out, and Rick really excelled at that.
Now, do you remember a particular news event where you remember his skill and at many levels being especially important?
there was an instance when the Register was launching a weekly publication that was trying to sort of establish itself as an edgy alternative weekly, and they had decided to use a four-letter word in print that wouldn't normally ever show up in a newspaper or even in an alternative weekly. And I remember Rick telling me that he had gone up to have a word with the editors of the weekly, and basically indicated that, you know, for whatever reason, that word shouldn't find its way back into print. He was old school, but he was open to new ideas. He mm-hmm. just didn't like it when people broke the rules just for the sake of breaking rules.
And it sounds like when communicating person to person, even when he had a difficult message to deliver, he was good at doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Rob Borsellino, the late columnist for the Des Moines Register, had pointed out that Rick was one of the few people, maybe the only guy in the newsroom, who everybody both liked and respected. And I think that sort of sums it up pretty nicely.
Clark Kaufman, investigative reporter for the Des Moines Register, thank you for helping us remember the former Des Moines Register managing editor, Richard Rick Tapscott, who died in 2013. Thank you, Clark.
Thank you.
A pioneering athletic figure that gave Iowa girls a nationally prominent role in high school sports died in May of 2013 at the age of 90. E. Wayne Cooley ran the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union for nearly 50 years. And here to help us remember him, Mark Donahoe is with us. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Ben.
You also worked at the Athletic Union, the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union, for many years. I wonder if you can take us back to remember when Cooley was hired to head the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union. It was not in great shape, I understand, in the 1950s.
No, that's correct. 1954, they were having financial trouble, and there had been quite a chance that it would have fallen by the wayside, and then girls' athletics would have been in the same position that they were in the other states around the country, which meant there really wouldn't have been girls' athletics until towards the late 70s and Title IX legislation.
Mm-hmm. What made him feel so strongly about making that have a bigger imprint?
Once he got into the position, he saw the potential of girls' athletics in Iowa, and he had a love affair with the Iowa girl and wanted her to be able to walk down the hallways of high schools with her head as high as the boys, and by his efforts through the years, he was able to accomplish that because he took the program from just having basketball, and then he within the next year or two he added track and then softball, and it moved on to tennis and golf and volleyball and swimming and certainly now soccer. So it was his own program in his own way, and he fell in love with it.
And people may not know how this sets Iowa apart from many other states. Tell us.
other than maybe Oklahoma or Texas, there weren't really high school athletics in the states other than on Iowa. It was a case where, you know, it just moved Iowa into the forefront of athletics, and it wasn't until Title IX legislation came along about 25 years after Mr. Cooley actually took over the girls' union that the female athletes in the other states were able to start to have athletics that were sponsored by their high schools and by colleges and so on and so forth. So once again, Iowa was ahead of its time, and a lot of that was due to Wayne Cooley.
I understand that E. Wayne Cooley was quite a colorful character. He was recalled in the Des Moines Register as a musician who once sat in with the Harry James Big Band Orchestra as it toured Iowa. He was an avid fan of Winston Churchill. In what ways was he colorful?
He was a man who knew how to lead. He was a man who had, liked to be in control. And if you didn't realize that about the first 10 seconds of being around Wayne Cooley, you were a slow learner. And if he would have moved on from the Girls Athletic Union after 5 years like he thought he was going to, I had no doubt that he would have been a leader in a major educational institution or a major business institution, because he had that capacity.
Let me ask you the It's a Wonderful Life question. What if there had not been an E. Wayne Cooley?
You know, during the time that he was there, in terms of athletics, there was no one that cast as big a shadow as he did on the state of Iowa. But whether you're a girl, a woman, or whether you're a boy or a man, you have a lot to owe to E. Wayne Cooley, because we guys we end up being fathers, and our daughters have had those opportunities that he provided through his leadership. So we have a lot to be thankful for what he accomplished during those years.
Mark Donhow, a Northeast Iowa businessman who knew and worked with E. Wayne Cooley for many years. Thank you for helping us remember his life and his achievements.
Thank you.
And finally, the iconic voice of Hawkeye sports was silenced this year. Jim Zobel was the play-by-play announcer for Iowa football for 49 years. And during his career, he was the voice of 6,100 sporting events, including this famous call of Marv Cook's touchdown against Ohio State in 1987. Jim Zobel died at his home in Scottsdale, Arizona, on May 23rd. He was 91. And we continue our remembrances after a break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
In heaven there is no beer. That's why we drink it here. And when we're gone from here, all our friends will be drinking all our beer. La la.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, we're remembering Iowans we lost in 2013. We're limited by time and want to acknowledge and apologize for omissions in advance. Waterloo civil rights pioneer and social work leader Ruth Anderson died in January of 2013. She was 91 years old. Anderson achieved many firsts in her half century of social and political involvement in Blackhawk County. She was the first African-American county social services director, also the first African-American county supervisor. She also made inroads for female professors at the University of Northern Iowa and helped create an entire academic department there. Joining us now to remember her life, Charlotte Nelson, former executive director of the Iowa Commission on the Status of Women. Charlotte Nelson, hello.
Hello.
Ruth Anderson was inducted into the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame in 1982, and I believe this was just before you began as executive director of the Iowa Commission on the Status of Women. Can you explain why she was recognized by the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame?
The recognition had a great deal to do with her social work and her concern and advocacy for female substance abusers and what she had done to prevent and treat substance abuse among women. At that time, women were much less likely to be diagnosed or treated for substance abuse than men.
Mm-hmm. Some of the first I mentioned, we can understand easily. The first African-American to serve on the Blackhawk County Board of Supervisors. What about the first African-American to serve as county social services director?
Interesting. She went into social work because when she was a child, her mother became a widow and had to go on public assistance. And after she was inducted into the Iowa Women's Hall of Fame, she wrote a book called From Mother's Aid Child to University Professor, an autobiography of an American black woman. And that was in 1985. As a social worker, then she helped to found the Department of Social Work at the University of Northern Iowa and became a full professor after, as you said, she advocated for herself to be granted full professorship with tenure. That was a first for women professors at the University of Northern Iowa. And then she had leadership role in the NAACP, both local, state, and interstate. So her advocacy went on to, and her strong social conscience went into working for equal rights for all people, including African Americans.
What would you say, how would you sum up the legacy of Ruth Anderson?
Just this year, the Department of Social Work at UNI has created a scholarship in her name. And they are saying that that is part of her legacy because it will assist low-income and minority students to pursue degrees in social work. So there's a whole legacy in terms of social work. But there's also a legacy in terms of her as a person who people from all walks of life who had the opportunity to know her or to hear of what she was doing were inspired to do the same kind of thing, to make this world a better place. I consider that a real legacy.
It certainly is. Charlotte Nelson, former executive director of the Iowa Commission on the Status of Women, thank you so much for helping us remember Ruth Anderson. Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Thank you very much.
In March, the inspirational blind athlete Sheila Holdsworth died after a long struggle with cancer. She was 51. Joining me to talk about her remarkable life, Matt Simpson, membership and outreach coordinator with the United States Association of Blind Athletes. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. It's good to be here.
Matt, Sheila lost her eyesight at the age of 10, and I understand it was due to a freak household accident. Can you tell us what happened?
Apparently it was through an orthodontics accident. She was doing some routine activities in her house, and one of the rubber bands on her braces snapped, and the sharp metal wires came out of her mouth and came up to hit her in the face. And due to the resulting infection, she ended up losing all of her vision and her eyeballs as well. So she ended up with prosthetic eyes.
Tell us about her athletic accomplishments.
She was a member of the seven-man team to the Paralympics in Innsbruck, Austria in 1984, where she took two gold medals and a silver medal for in the skiing events, downhill and slalom skiing.
Some people may wonder, sighted people may wonder, how in the heck do you slalom ski, especially without eyesight?
Usually skiers will use a a partner, a guide who will help them down the mountain. And this guy gives verbal commands, usually from behind. So her guide would have been skiing very close, either behind or in front, giving her cues as when to turn. They probably scouted out the course before to pick up cues on the terrain and the condition of the snow. And then once that happened, it's all downhill from there. And a ski racer who's blind attacks the mountain just like a ski racer who's sighted, and the only difference being they have no idea where they're going. So it's a lot of trust.
She was also, in August of 1981, the first blind woman to scale Mount Rainier in Washington State. That's over 14,000 feet high. I understand that was a trip that nearly turned deadly.
They encountered some rough conditions, and an avalanche was pretty close to being a serious issue for her party. But she was fearless and managed to not only survive the experience, but go on to continue and climb the mountain.
You know, some younger listeners especially may not appreciate the societal forces she was up against, because we're talking about the 1980s, several decades ago, when accomplishments by blind athletes were not seen in the same light as they are today. Can you put that into context for us, where we were in the 80s when she was making these advances?
She certainly was a pioneer. The expectations are always going to be low for someone with a disability. And to do something that most people sighted or blind or otherwise don't do, climbing a mountain, being an international elite athlete, those are things that truly help to advance disability in our society. They mm-hmm. help to serve as examples for future generations of people with disabilities. They also help to serve as examples for the able-bodied general society at large, and show them not only what people with disabilities are capable of, but also what you can do as a person without a disability. I think that's a truly motivational concept. Right. I think that spirit that Sheila's so well typified, I think that is the best way to remember her, is to truly take any opportunity and not let those conditions hold you back.
Matt Simpson with me, remembering Sheila Holdsworth, a real trailblazer. Sheila Holdsworth died after a long struggle with cancer in March. Matt Simpson, membership and outreach coordinator with the United States Association of Blind Athletes. Thanks for sharing with us.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour, remembering Iowans in our news who passed away in 2013. In June, William A. Krause died at the age of 78. That's not a name you may recognize, but you certainly recognize the name Come and Go. The West Des Moines entrepreneur built Come and Go into the nation's fifth largest privately held convenience store chain. William Krause was born and raised in Eldora. He graduated from the University of Iowa with a degree in journalism and public relations back in 1957. Joining us now to remember William A. Krause is his son, Kyle J. Krause, CEO of Come and Go currently. Kyle, hi.
Hi, Ben.
Our condolences to you.
Well, thank you very much. I certainly appreciate that, and appreciate you taking the time to talk about my father.
Right after graduating from the University of Iowa, your father formed a partnership with his father-in-law, T.S. Gentle, and together they pioneered a convenience store concept that we know today all across the U.S. And our younger listeners, Kyle, will scarcely remember that gas stations never used to have any kind of store attached to them.
Yes, correct. Yeah, there was the service bays where you went there to get your car fixed and bought gasoline only.
So how did he come up with this idea?
Well, one, he wasn't very mechanical, so he wasn't going to be very good fixing cars, so he knew that wasn't a good idea for him. But I think it was the trends of what you saw happening on a nationwide basis. You started to see this connection with the small grocery and gas becoming a convenience concept. And so I think for him, it was a connection of this is what we want to provide for the customers.
So how large is Come and Go today?
We have 427 stores, about 4,600 associates, and we'll do about $3 billion in revenue this year.
In 2005, the convenience store Petroleum magazine named your father one of the top 10 most influential CEOs. In 2008, the same publication named him the industry's retail leader of the year. What qualities made your father such a great entrepreneur and business leader?
Well, really, he had a really strong passion around people. And those people are twofold. I mean, he loved the come and go people, and he had a real knack of knowing, remembering, and personalizing his relationship even as the company grew. And we'd stop in stores, and we used to do store tours. We'd visit every single store every year. And on those visits, where Dad maybe would see the general manager once a year, he'd remember that, you know, her son was a baseball player and ask about how his baseball's going. And he had this connection to people that was really extraordinary. And I think the same, certainly what he had with the Come and Go people, he tried to instill upon all of us in Come and Go to have with our customers, that really the customer was first from a Come and Go standpoint, that, you know, anybody can build a brand new store next week and be a better store physical asset than what you had. But how are you going to win in business is taking care of your people and taking care of the customer.
Your father was also a great philanthropist, was he not?
Yes. I mean, he was active all of his career, then and still today. Come and Go donates 10% of our profits every year in philanthropy. And then also being engaged from being active on boards in the communities and state and national basis. And the same thing that he tried to pass on to us from a family standpoint. But he also was the type who would, people would write him letters. He'd read the stories in the paper about people who were down and out. And, you know, he would, you know, grab his checkbook and, you know, write the $300 check to cover their whatever bills they had that month or whatever the story was. And those are the types of things that don't get in the paper, but would have been, you know, what his personality was. My dad grew up very poor and could relate to people who didn't have anything because he didn't have anything.
Sounds like such a great man. Kyle Krause, thank you for helping us remember your father, William A. Krause, who died this past year.
Well, Ben, thank you, and thank you for the time to recognize my father. I certainly truly appreciate it.
And we're sorry for your loss again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pauline Phillips, known to the world as Dear Abby, died January 16th in Minneapolis at the age of 94 this past year. The tart-tongued advice columnist had a longtime professional rivalry with her twin sister, Esther, also known as Ann Landers. The sisters were known simply to their Sioux City neighbors as the Friedman twins. Charity Nebbe talked with Grace Linden, curator of the Sioux City Public Museum, Lynn Zerschling, columnist for the Sioux City Journal, and Bruce Miller of the Sioux City Journal earlier this year.
When they were at Morningside College, they both started writing.
Right. There was a Morningside College newspaper column called The Campus Rat, and you weren't supposed to know who was writing the answers, so they had a pen name called Peep, P-E-E-P, and that was for their first and middle initials of the two girls together. So they wrote the column together, and nobody was supposed to know who they were, but I think they figured it out.
You know, Lynn, I would love to hear, did your mom share her opinions? Your mother was a pioneer journalist. I mean, there weren't a lot of women journalists at this time. And, of course, Anne and Abby were pioneers in their own field, although they kind of stuck with a more traditional woman's role. Did your mom have opinions about that?
She thought they were great. And one of the reasons she thought that is that as advice columnists, they kind of broke the mold from the old sob sister type. You probably talked about that earlier. But she felt that they not only brought attention to a lot of issues that hadn't been discussed, but she thought they brought attention to Sioux City because both the twins were very positive about Sioux City, their upbringing, where they got their values. And when they came back, they remembered who people were. They didn't have to be prompted, oh, that's Joan so-and-so from Central High or Morningside College. They remembered names. They were good at that. My mother thought they were good role models.
Grace, since the sisters did leave Sioux City, was there any... It sounds like they were good about being true to the city that they came from, and it sounds like people in Sioux City still felt like they had ownership of them.
Oh, sure. They came back as early as 1957. Abby was asked to be keynote speaker at her Morningside College alumni event. But if there was anything going on within the family, They had a wedding of a niece one time. They asked all the reporters not to interview them, that this was their niece's big day. She was getting married. They didn't want to be in the news. They wanted the niece to have all the glory for her wedding time.
All right. And Bruce, you wrote a blog post about both of them, but I mean, particularly about Pauline. But you described her as being somebody who could just light up a room.
They were both like that. I'll tell you, they were different. One was more motherly and one was more businesslike, if that makes any sense.
Okay, well, then tell us which one was which.
Abby was more like your mom, and she would be very kind of folksy. She would call out of the blue. I would be sitting at work one day, and I'd get a call from Abby, and she'd say, how are things doing in Sioux City? And she really wanted to know. Whereas with Anne, she was a little more businesslike, and you had to go through the proper channels if you wanted to talk to her.
And then how did you meet Abby?
Abby was after I got to the Journal. And of course, now we're going back to 1979. It was just a regular thing. And like I say, I had her home phone number. We would talk on the phone every once in a while. She'd ask about things in town. I think she felt that I was a safe person to ask about things. And she'd say, how's the Green Gables? And how's this? And how's that? And
the Green Gables, probably the most famous restaurant in Sioux City,
they love to go there. And and she'd throw things out. And it was like really, it was like having an old friend who wanted to know how her hometown was. But, I never asked her for advice. Sadly, I probably should have done that at some point and said, can you give me some advice for a change? But very friendly. She was like somebody that you knew for years. And she'd always give you a big hug. And she'd always leave by saying, make sure you tell all my friends hello.
Pauline Phillips died January 16th at the age of 94. The remarkable life of Air Force Colonel, former Vietnam POW, and Medal of Honor recipient, George Bud Day. He died earlier this year at the age of 88. Day was born February 24th, 1925, in Sioux City. That's where the airport is now named for him. Joining me now to remember George Bud Day, Master Sergeant John Sandman of the 185th Air Refueling Wing, who was a friend of Day. John, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
George Bud Day received the Medal of Honor among many other awards. He received that Medal of Honor for escaping his captors for 10 days after the aircraft he was piloting was shot down over North Vietnam in 1967. In all, 70 medals during his service during World War II, Korea, Vietnam. I'm wondering, are there servicemen? That's a rare thing, isn't it, to have served in all three of those wars, isn't it?
Exactly. That's so rare. And to keep moving up in leadership positions and earn the respect that he has is equally rare. But the great sense of humor that Colonel Day had, he said someone asked him about all his medals and awards, and he said if you look real close though, you'll see that I did not have the good conduct ribbon here. Joking that in his younger days he was out there and a typical young Iowa boy and living on the edge a little bit maybe.
Okay. Later, veterans will be thankful that he became a crusader for veterans' health care benefits. What can you tell us about that?
The most amazing thing, and some of us have talked to him, and he kind of jokes about that maybe God kept him alive for that reason. He literally, World War II and Korean veterans were promised health care if they served. But unfortunately, a lot of those promises were verbal promises. There was a few instances where they were written down, but it wasn't a nationwide thing. But they were being denied health care. So Colonel Day literally sued the United States government. Here, so you have a Medal of Honor winner suing the government, the most patriotic human being you can find, suing his government to provide health care for the veterans. And it went through a couple higher courts and eventually was turned down by the Supreme Court. But because of his lawsuit against the government to provide health care for veterans, TRICARE for Life was passed by Congress. And I can't tell you how many veterans I saw come up and hug Colonel Day, shake his hand, tears in their eyes, and so grateful that they said, Colonel, you know, because of this, my stomach ailment got cured. Because of this, my leg was fixed. Because of this. And he was so humble. He'd say, no, it wasn't me. I'm glad it happened. And, you know, he would never take credit for it. But the fact of the matter is, American military members today have TRICARE for Life almost 100% entirely because of Colonel Day's actions.
Master Sergeant John Sandman of the 185th Air Refueling Wing, we want to thank you for helping us remember this great Iowan. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, sir.
Bud Day died July 27th at the age of 88. We also remember Iowa's peace officers and service members lost in 2013. Rockwell City Police Officer Jamie Bunting was shot and killed during a standoff at a home on September 13th. Officer Bunting had served with the four-officer Rockwell City Police Department for 8 years and had served in law enforcement for a total of 12 years. And Army Staff Sergeant Stephen P. Blass was killed March 11th in Kandahar, Afghanistan, when his Black Hawk helicopter crashed. He was only 27. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.